Thursday, and we are very excited and honored today to have Zhang He and Chris as our speakers. And I will give us a brief introduction of Zhang He and Chris. It might be a bit long, so please bear with me. Zhang He is one of China's most successful young writers and the author of three short story collections, Air Cannon, Neighborhood Adventures, and Prima Donna, among which Air Cannon won the inaugural Blank Pen Imaginist Literary Prize, and Prima Donna won the inaugural Zhongshan Star Annual Youth Prize. Zhang He is a graduate from Fudan University, based in Shanghai, and she's working as a part-time Chinese teacher in the International Baccalaureate program. Her writing zooms in on the lives of the working class urban Chinese, often in the setting of Shanghai neighborhoods. Christopher is a translator and public service interpreter based in Cardiff. He's a postgraduate from the Montreal Institute of International Studies, and he's also a member of the Chartered Institute of Linguists. His first book, The Sense of War, Sun Tzu's Art of War Retranslated and Reconsidered, came out in 2018 and received high praise. He won the Coma Press Emerging Translator Award in 2019 and co-translated Sue Volunteer's Diary for Paper Republic in 2020. Christopher previously lived and worked for over 20 years in Taipei, Hong Kong, and Shanghai. You can see that both Zhang He and Chris the experience is closely intertwined with the city of Shanghai. And we know they join us today as the author and the translator of this anthology, The Book of Shanghai, which Chantal just showed us, and it's this book. So I will give us a brief introduction of this book as well. The book come this anthology came out in April last year during the first lockdown in the UK. And is the outcome of the collaboration between the Manchester Confucius Institute, Coma Press, and the Fudan University. After release, it has received positive reviews around the world. This book is the 17th edition of Coma Press' Reading the Cities series, and also its first book of China's Cities series. This book presents a panorama of Shanghai, featuring 10 engaging stories by 10 prominent Chinese contemporary Chinese writers, setting against 10 different places of Shanghai at 10 different moments in recent Shanghai history, including one in the imagined future. Characters in these stories are all on a mission, whether it's responding to events around them or follow some impulse of their own. They show a determined refusal to lose themselves in the hurtling metropolis that might otherwise leave them anonymous, disconnected, all alone. So these are the introductions, and the story of Amin is one of the stories in these collections, and the story is really exquisitely depicted by Zhang He and equally brilliantly translated by Chris. And our postgraduate Chen and Yaqi, they really love the story very much, so they have prepared some questions for you today. And today I will invite Chris and Zhang He to share with us their favorite part of the story, and then Chen and Yaqi will ask their questions. If you also have some questions to ask, we will have a 10-minute Q&A session in the end, but please feel free to send your questions throughout the talk using the chat function at the bottom of the screen. There's a purple button, I think you can see there. And okay, let's start. So Zhang He, before we start reading, could you give us a brief idea of what the story is about?
Okay. Hi everyone, I'm Zhang He. Glad to see you here. And let me introduce my story. It begins with an old woman who was discovered in a dustbin in a very hot summer morning. And people gathered there to see whether she was dead or not. And then they recognized it was Amin, an old lady who lived in a locked-up garage. Actually, this old lady has her own family, including son and grandson. But since she became obsessed with collecting rubbish, and being dirty and crazy. Both her family and neighborhood disliked her and even hated her. This story is trying to figure out why this old lady come to be like that way, and why she has a such a weird hobby and why going to crazy. That's the whole story of family.
Thanks for the very intriguing introduction, Jianhei. And Chris, I think your favorite part can well answer the questions from Jianhei and also explain Armin's decline. So may I ask you to read for us first?
Yeah, gladly. Right. Hello, everyone. So as Jianhei mentioned, the story begins with this rather shocking scene with this old lady being pulled from a big sort of wheelie bin, alive or dead, no one knows really at that point. And then it steps back and it takes you on a sort of narrative through her story, how she came to be in that condition, how she came to go from being a respectable member of the community and neighbor and so on to this condition. And the excerpt I'm going to read is from about halfway through the story, and it marks a particular point in that transition, that decline she's going through, when something is crossed or something sort of irreversible happens, and as a reader you sort of know there's no going back. Old Arming was roaming further from home and coming back even later, and while Arsene didn't object, he wasn't exactly happy with the situation. For one thing, it was embarrassing. Everybody could see her traipsing about, a mother sent out by her son to collect scrap to support the family. People would be laughing about it. And to add to that, she was falling behind on the shopping and cooking. When a child came home, he'd wail he was hungry, and then Arsene would get mad. No one's making you go around collecting scrap. Stop it now. It makes us look terrible. Stay home and look after the child. Food on the table 3 times a day. That's what you need to worry about. Got it? Arsene always barked out orders. It wasn't worth talking back. The old lady agreed to stop, but furtively carried on. She took a shopping bag to market, but came back with an extra sack of pickings. When people hailed her on the street, it used to be, "Arming, you're back from the market." Now it was more like, "Arming, you've got some new stock in." She would let out an uncomfortable laugh, then scuttle off to stash her haul as quickly as possible. She was like a thief hiding stolen goods. Some of what she brought back was packed away outside the back window, and some at the bottom of the stairwell. Kids found her collection of soft drink bottles under a stone bench and started kicking them around. Arming went after them to get the bottles back. "Little wretches, who said you could touch those?" Slowly dawned on people that Arming was collecting increasingly random items. "She brings it all back with her, sellable or not." That's how the scrap collector with the three-wheeler put it. He was kicking himself for getting involved with her in the first place. Now he couldn't pass the garage without being dragged over. "Come and have a look. Come and have a look." "I've told the old lady time and again, you can't sell this kind of material," he said. "It just won't sell, but she keeps on collecting it." As the frown on his face indicated, Arming had become a big nuisance for him and his operation, as well as for everyone else. People shook their heads. They muttered about what was up with Arming, but never let anything slip in front of her son. He had such a vile temper. Eventually, an affordable flat came through for Arsene and his wife. They scraped together the down payment and got busy fitting out the new place, leaving their son's daily routine in Arming's hands. Within a few days, someone worked up the courage to tell Arsene that they'd seen Arming and the boy scavenging waste on a building site. Ceramic tiles, fluorescent tubes, that sort of thing. Arsene hurtled home, furious. He went straight to the garage where he saw the mass of junk. Arming put on a smile and was about to show him what everything was for when he launched into an angry tirade. "The new flat's mine and fitting it up is my business. You're not paying for it and you're not to get involved. Grubbing around for other people's dregs like this when you're old enough to be dead, what a disgrace. Be senile all you want, but dragging the child into it, what the hell were you thinking?" It was around dinner time and Arsene had a booming voice so all the neighbors heard. He went upstairs, slammed the door, and never let Armin take the child out on her own again. Thanks.
Thanks for the very emotional reading, Chris. And Chunyan, over to you.
Hi.
Hello, Chris and Zhanghei. I'm so excited to ask you these questions that I have prepared because I really enjoyed reading the story of Amin. So my first two questions are for Chris. Chris, since you have just read part six of this story, my question is, is this part of the translation your favorite? And have you ever encountered some difficulties when you are rendering this part of the translation?
Okay, I mean, I like this part of the story in particular because it's, as I say, it's got this interesting transition point when I think it dawns on you as a reader, like, uh-oh, this is getting bad sort of thing. She's now been sort of cut off by, you know, abandoned by her son and his wife. In terms of translation, I mean, I think to be honest, there was anything so especially difficult about this compared with other sections, but I wanted to, I thought it was worth selecting because it illustrates a feature that I really like about this story, which is the way that the narrative or the narrative voice just sort of seems to flow kind of effortlessly between the narrator, the traditional narrator you'd expect, and then the sort of collective voice of people in the community, and then the sort of individual voices of some people. And it's so nicely done, I think, you know, particularly in the Chinese, because there's no, you know, you don't get quotation marks coming in and say, right, now someone's talking, now they're not sort of talking. It's all woven in. And it, you know, as a reader, I think it gives you a sense of, you know, as I say, it's like a collective voice. It's like the whole community is speaking and watching and observing what's happened, and you're brought into that. You're almost part of it. So I'll just give you a couple of examples from this section. You know, you have right at the beginning, you have Arsene, that's her son, didn't object, and he wasn't exactly happy with the situation. For one thing, it was embarrassing. Everyone could see her traipsing about, blah, blah, blah. People would be laughing about it. You're sort of getting into his head now. You're not quite sure whether it's actually him saying that or it's some kind of objective narrator, and you're sort of there with him. You know, you empathize, if you like, with what he's going, what his attitude is. A little bit later, the other scrap collector guy, he was kicking himself for getting involved with her in the first place. Now he couldn't pass the garage without being dragged over. Come and have a look. Come and have a look. Well, actually, that come and have a look, of course, is Arming speaking, but it's just sort of there. It's like it's part of the scene, you know, that you're observing. Within a few days, someone worked up the courage to tell Arsene they'd seen Arming and the boy scavenging for waste on a building site, ceramic tiles, fluorescent tubes, that sort of thing. And it was that little, you know, that could have just been the narrator, but that little sort of that sort of thing makes you think, actually, this is probably what the person said. But again, it's all part of the narrative. It's seamless. That's something that happens throughout this story, which is what, you know, as soon as I saw the sample, that's what really attracted me to this story. I was so excited and felt very privileged to be able to translate it.
Okay. My next question is something that maybe translators have to face. So as a translator, Chris, have you ever encountered the situation where you have to revise the original for the better reception for the target culture or the target readers? Do you have something to say about that?
Yeah. I can give you a couple of little examples where I've made little tweaks, should we say. I used to work as a translator in the 1990s, and sometimes I taught translation as well. And but I never did literary translation back then. This was my first real effort, literary translation. But I think the way I worked then, I was always, you know, frankly scared to make a mistake. So I tended to, you know, focus very closely on the words, and the bottom line, you know, was always, you know, you're going to try and translate as directly, as simply as you can, from almost, you know, almost word to word. I mean, obviously, you don't literally do word to word, because that kind of keeps you honest. It nails you down, you know. And I found doing this, translating this story, of course, there's times when you can't go word for word, because you're not, you know, when you're translating a piece of art, if you like, you know, you're not just moving like facts from here to there. You're looking for images and feelings and things that you want to translate from this culture, if you like, or this realm into this realm with a bunch of different people and a different. You know, so yes, I would say, you know, on a structural level, certainly paragraph by paragraph, even sentence by sentence, I'm following the structure in the story. But then within the sentence, you know, all kinds of things happen. I mean, the first thing is, and this was, is destroy the syntax. This was something that was told to us on the Work Translates summer school a couple of years ago, that one of the senior tutors there told us, you know, destroy. You know, when you're going from Chinese to English, and I'm sure vice versa, you often have to sort of completely turn a sentence back to front because of the sort of tradition, you know, the conventional way the syntax is structured. But it's very easy accidentally to carry across the syntax from your source language into your target language. So you kind of have to go back through your result and then try and undo as much of that syntax as possible. Then, you know, so yeah, in terms of like, you know, maybe tweaking a couple of words, a word that gets used a lot in this story, Chinese Xiaoqu, this place where everyone lives. And, you know, it was a real challenge for me in English, and I went through every kind of permutation of possible things and ended up, I don't know, community and housing complex and neighborhood and blah, blah, blah. Ended up settling on this word estate, you know, and it's not ideal, but it was kind of, it seemed to me the nearest I could get, because what I was seeing from a Xiaoqu, this kind of Xiaoqu in Shanghai, was this kind of tatty neighborhood, a lot of people living quite close together. They're not really a community, I mean, but they know a lot about each other, but they don't necessarily really care deeply for each other. But what they've got is a kind of entrance, there's a common entrance to this neighborhood, so it gives it a kind of identity, you know, one way or the other. And it made me think of, in Britain, we have these things called housing estates or council estates, and they were particularly built in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. Just reminded me a little bit of that. So and especially they have a problem with bins, I should say, especially back then. You know, you have these big, wheelie, smelly, wheelie bins that no one was looking after, and it was, you know, so I lived in one for a few years. So I made that, I transplanted, if you like, you know, Zhanhe's Xiaoqu to a kind of estate in Britain, and it's kind of got pros and cons, but, it, you know, so if you like, I took a bit of a liberty there. And another example, I don't know if you remember, anyone who's read it, that there's a section near the beginning where it describes when older people are going a bit, not all of us, of course, but as some people get old, they can go a bit batty or a bit dotty or a bit off the rails or something like this. And in Shanghainese, I guess, the narrator introduces this phrase, lao lai bian, something like they're old and something's changed, you know. And then the story then explains just what this means. So it's kind of clear to me that maybe not even Chinese readers would automatically know what this means without the examples. So I felt I had to come up with some kind of phrase, and I really agonized over this for a long time, and I ended up just gone different, because if like making up a phrase that doesn't really exist in English, but because all the examples were there, you know, I said so-and-so's gone different, as opposed to, you know, when they've gone off the rails. And then there's this, you know, one of the examples is family, the old man in his 80s has maybe taken a much younger wife, and everyone else in the family is really disgusted by this and really kind of puritanically saying, oh, this is an absolutely shameless old, you know, blah blah blah, you know, Buyaolian and similar. And I kind of inserted a little bit there where they said, the old goat, or whatever, you know, he's taken a younger wife, the old goat. Well, there was nothing in Chinese about goats or even about that, but it just seemed to me that was the sort of vibe of what they were saying then, and I just, that was the thing that popped into mind in English there. So yeah, little tweaks like that throughout.
Okay, thank you, Chris. My next question is for Zhanhe. Zhanhe, you know, here in the Warwick writing program, a lot of the audience are creative writers or to-be writers. So you as a professional writer, I really want to pick up your brain about some like skills or tips about writing. So my first question is that, what would you do if you got stuck when you are writing and you don't know what to write next? What would you do in such a situation?
Oh, it usually happens, yeah. Different situation. I think when I have already started a new story, also say I'm in a writing program, I will keep it going on for any reason. I have to continue until its end. But if I haven't started a new text, but it happens that I don't know what to write for the next, And I would tell myself to just stop it and doing something else. Like what I usually do is to walking around the city and watching films and TV programs and just do some reading for the relax. I do think we all need a balance between writing career and daily life. Also say like input and output of a machine or a person who works on a flat road and between climbing mountains. And we have to admit we cannot climb the mountain for all the time. So it's better to just take a relax and spend time on relaxing and have a adjustment to recover energy. And if you think you have get prepared to keep going, then you can start a new journey of write. Yeah. But if your program is already gone, I think it's better to just keep going on. Yeah. That's my habit to write.
Yes, thank you. And my last question for you is, in terms of the materials for writing, I want to ask you, how do you decide what to write? Are the things that you are interested in or you are good at, or the things that you think your potential readers might be interested in? Do you have a particular group of potential readers in your mind when you begin to write?
Definitely, I would choose the one interested me first, not for the readers. Yeah, because I think I write for myself first. I'm curious with many things in our daily life. So many of my stories first came from a vague question or focused on a certain topic or a social phenomena, especially in the story of Amin. At that time, I have seen a lot of old men in different communities and cities who love to collect rubbish to get close with the dustbins. And after some investigation, I find they're not for the economic reason nor for the environmental health volunteer thing, jobs. So I'm going to think why. I don't know. I'm wondering what they're thinking. And as a writer, I think it's the best way to try to understand them by imagine their inner words. But if you cannot go inside their hearts, maybe to write down what they have gone through and the relationship between their families, folks, and neighborhood. So to write a story is just to unveil some riddles and questions in my mind.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's all for my questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chen.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for your thought-provoking questions, Chen Yan, and thank you for your engaging answers, Chris and Zhang He. And the next part, I will ask Zhang He to share with her favorite part of the story, and it's also the ending of the story. It reveals the ending of Amin, and I bet everyone can't wait to know. So can we start the reading, Zhang He?
It's my turn to read the last session.
Yeah, if you're ready.
Okay. We've gone to the last session. We've gone to the end.
Yeah, it's very fast. But we will have a lot of time for questions, and that's a good thing.
Okay. On a particular night, Armin had rummaged about in the bins for too long at the end of a boiling hot day and had finally succumbed. Maybe because it was airless in those bins or just too smelly. But this time she didn't end up in hospital. "Motherfucker," exclaimed the rubbish man as he dragged her out. People heading to work stopped for a look, pinching their noses as they approached, then hastily backing off from the stench. The rubbish man prodded Armin with his foot and got his dog to have a sniff. She lay motionless. Someone said, "Quick, get an ambulance." "What's the point?" someone else said. "Call Arsene, tell him to come and get the body." A little crowd formed, standing well back from the inner figure under its cloud of light. Rancid fluid spread across the ground toward them. The rubbish man went to the river, returned with a bucket of water, and emptied it over Armin. After a couple of moments, she came to. She wasn't dead. The rubbish man moved on to the next building, and the workers quickly dispersed. They have to get away from the smell. Armin had rummaged through so many bins, she was like walking refuse. Face to face with the living dead first thing in the morning, talking about bad omens, muttering grimly. Everyone stood around the bin and skirted the patch of ground where Armin had lain. But there wasn't a single bin on the estate that Armin hadn't foraged at the same point. And there was no way of the estate without passing her garage. There was no getting around Armin. Wherever some item had been disposed of by some person, Armin had been there. Whatever it was, Armin wanted. It was just no one wanted Armin. Only the banks wanted her now. Recycled rubbish and non-recycled rubbish. It was all the same to her. The banks gave Armin food and they gave her shelter. They gave her everything she desired. And this past night, to sleep in the big green bin, it feels so good. It feels so peaceful. Armin stood up, patted herself down, and returned to her garage. Beaming with pleasure, she put out the shining sewing machine. "Now then, let's have a look. What a first-rate material. Just the same for disposable nappies." Armin tucked the molded sheets of rubber from her front and began lightly working the treadle. Yeah, that's the end of story.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing it with us. And yes, really heartbreaking story. So now, Yachi, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, over to you.
Yeah, thank you, Chris, Zhanghei, for reading. It's really nice to have you today. And I'm going to round up our discussion by focusing on this ending, this tragic ending of the story. And I might start by asking a question for you both. It's about the finale that Jay just shared with us. Like, for me, it was really desperate because it reveals a shocking image of aging. A woman in her dotage, senile, dirty, useless, and unloved. And Jay and Chris, what do you think are the main culprits of this, of the tragedy of Armin? Like, I echo strongly with Chris when he first mentioned, like, about the dismingling of voices, about, you know, the private or the personal voice being tainted by the community, by the voice of the community, by the other people's opinion. Is it something, you know, this particular atmosphere in Chinese estate that contributes to the tragedy of Armin, or it is something more psychological? I'd like to hear your opinion on this. We might start with Zhanghei and then move on to Chris, if that's okay. Jianhe, would you like to share with us your reading of the ending, like the main corporate, the reason, like you mentioned, you know, introduction, why, why Omni?
Okay, I'm thinking of a thing that is when I first published this article in an online magazine, my editor said that the title of Story of ABC is too cliche and it's boring, too boring to attract readers' eyes. So we named it a new title as What Is She Catching? It's another name of this story, kind of What Is She Catching? And I think when I think of this, I think this question is maybe a good answer to your question. We don't know what on earth Armin is trying to catch him. Obviously, it's not just for money or for spend time or for the environmental or just to make others get notice on her. Obviously, that's not enough to explain why she came into a crazy way. And another sentence I think of is very popular on Chinese internet called 他吃的不是饭，他吃的是寂寞, which can be translated as what he's having is not a meal. He's having his loneliness. And maybe it can also be used on Armin. Maybe she's just catching something else other than rubbish. It's about emptiness or loneliness. And you know, many old women in Chinese family, especially in of the working class, when they're young, they regard themselves as the assistants of their folks, and they dedicate all their lifetimes to the family. And when they get old, after their husband died and their children had their own family, and even their grandchildren have grown up without their help, they may feel meaningless or useless to the family. That is a question, a new question for the old men, is how to live in their late times of life, how to live at their old age. Just live for who? Like, without sons and grandsons, can you just live for yourself, and can you do the things you really wanted? And I think Armin want to continue to dedicate something to her family and to her folks, but in fact they didn't need her. That is an unbalanced thing. So it's pretty sad to happen in Armin. And if we want to rewrite this ending, to change it into a better one, maybe the person who can save this end is not the writer, is Armin herself. Yeah, maybe that's it.
Thank you. That's really beautiful what you said. I really agree with you on the sense, like, living for whom is especially a question for Chinese elderly. So I think maybe Chris had more to say on this because he lives in a very different context. And please share with us your thoughts on this, Chris, on his fate. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Yashi. That word, culprit in your question sort of caught my attention there, it's certainly tempting when you're a reader to look for someone to blame in the story, isn't it, or sort of find things to blame. but I don't think this story does that. And that's one of the things I like about it very much. You know, this story is more or less, it's non-judgmental. It's just telling things as they are. And then, you know, who's to blame? Well, maybe that's beyond the scope of the story. This is just how they are. And I find that's a real strength, actually, because, you know, sometimes if a story has a moral, the moral of the story, and you feel it's being led to make you make this, you know, to guide you to make a particular judgment, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's some kind of a story. But in this kind of a story, you know, you have the freedom to appraise the situation as you like, or you don't have to appraise it. It's just what it is. And I like that very much. So, you know, so as I say, it'd be tempting when I was reading it. It certainly was tempting to think, how can Arsene and his wife be so horrible? You know, what happened to filial piety, for example? You know, surely you should, or all the neighbors, they know what was happening to her. Couldn't they have just checked in, or, you know, that kind of thing. Do you say, oh, it was society, you know, it's the city, whatever. You could find all kinds of factors, I suppose, that have contributed, but it's almost not relevant because her life is what it is, and she, you know, this is how she is, and this story is telling you there, and it's, you know, there are no answers really, are there? Because, you know, there are many people for whom life doesn't turn out great necessarily, and this is how it is, you know, and we sort of that doesn't make it, but the story is absolutely fascinating because it's bringing you into that story of one particular individual who's been through this. And as I said before, it's all doing this all from this sort of collective viewpoint of the whole neighborhood, which I think we can all relate to in a way. You know, someone who we don't know very well may even be a stranger to us, or maybe someone we do know quite well, but they've got this whole kind of hinterland of their own experience that we don't know about and we're not really going to get involved in. But we'll hear in the story, you do, you know, the story takes you through the whole kind of background, and it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, very well said, Chris. I this reminds me of your translation of the word collecting rubbish. You translated it as grasping at one point in the story. Grasping.
God, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. It's like I'm trying too hard to grasp what lies behind the tragedy bombing, but actually there might be so many factors that can, you know, we would help lead. Keep track of them. Mm. Yes. So it's like a pawn, like the word you used, grasping garbage. I don't know. But let's move on to the next question. That's for Zhang Hei. Zhang Hei very kindly gave us an update of the story a week ago. She sent us a picture of a notice pasted on a dumpster on an estate in Shanghai. So it's the same context when we are reading the story by name. The notice reads, caution, the mutating COVID-19 can be transmitted through contact with virus-contaminated objects. Thus, skip diving is strictly forbidden on the estate. Any violation will be reported to the public sector and issued a fine of 500 yuan. So please comply with the rule. So this is a very telling notice, and I'm really interested in Zhang Hei's response and reading of this, and how, in what way do you think it is related to the story we're reading today? Thank you.
I saw this picture from a WeChat group where people love to search rubbish, especially like abandoned furniture in the street of Shanghai. For example, when you see a desk in the corner of the street, you can just take a photo and upload to the chat group. And don't forget to share the location in the group. And then the others can go straight there to get it if they just need it. It's a cheap way for the young people who rent a house to live in Shanghai. Then they can use used furniture instead of buying a new one in IKEA or something. And people in this chat group for joking called this group as a rubbish group. Yeah. And one day I saw this picture in the group, and many friends typed ha 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 in this group, and I was also laughing, and immediately I think of Armin, And I bet Ami will ignore this notice even if she sees it. She's and keep going on with her lovely dustbins. But will she just get infected with coronavirus through the dustbins? I don't know. Even if not, will the neighborhood hate her more than ever before because of dirty and dangerous, even to call the police? Imagine when the police come, and will they ask Armin to pay for the 5 yuan for the fine? And I don't know all these situations, but I know there are a lot of Armins living around us, and they may get into this trouble during the endless COVID time. Yeah, because we know this situation when can be ended.
Yeah, thanks for sharing with us. I think offer much food for thought. It's a really tragic thing. I just think that your old people do, you know, gathering rubbish for whatever reason, and you know, the coronavirus might put an end to this. Yeah, and the third question I want to ask Chris about the translating process. Like, I was really curious about, you know, from a comparative perspective, when you translate and when you read the story for the first time, did any like Western Anglophone short stories come to mind, or any, you know, English writers that also write about aging, or, you know, old people who are perhaps? Really curious to know your thoughts on this. Thank you.
Right. I'm not sure. When I first read it, and when I started translating it, I didn't really have a model in mind in terms of English short story writing. You know, something about the tone, the atmosphere did remind me of Lu Xun, actually. You know, which I remember reading some of his stories when I was learning Chinese, you know, long time ago, which I always really loved and admired. But actually reading it back, reading the translation back, the story that came to mind is a novel by an English author called Jean Rhys, and it was The White Sargasso Sea. Mm-hmm. And for anyone who doesn't know it, it takes up the story of a character who's known as the Mad Woman in the Attic from the book Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte, written in the Victorian era. And it develops, you know, so in Jane Eyre, there's this character, a really pivotal figure in the whole sort of story, who is, she's the mad woman in the attic. She, you know, you know very little else about her apart from that one fact. She's married to one of the main characters, or, you know, the love interest character, Mr. Rochester, and for some reason she's locked in the attic and she's mad, and that's kind of all you really know about her. And it's quite brutal, really. And in Jean Rhys's story, she gives this woman a name, Antoinette. She's not just Mrs. You know, and she gives her a story, and she gives her a voice, because she you know, she, it's in the first person much of it, and she tells the story herself. And through reading this book, you come to know this woman. When she was young, she was free and happy. She lived on this island in the Caribbean, tropical place, you know. And then circumstances outside of her control, the family's disintegrating. You know, they were once wealthy and owned a plantation, and they were slow, but all that's in the past now. They're despised by the local people. She gets tricked into marriage by this unscrupulous English gentleman who is actually just after her money, doesn't love and care for her. She gets like shipped across to England, put in this great big mansion to live with him. You know, no friends, no one understands, you know, her life on this tropical island that she's come from. And bit by bit, the situation, you know, it gets worse, and she ends up being sort of quote unquote mad and locked in this attic. And it's, of course, the book White Sargasso Sea is a real kind of revelation, because it took this character who'd been sort of neglected or shunned almost, not only in the, you know, in the story, but in reality, and opens her up, you know, this whole story that actually explained how she came to be where she's at. And you have this whole empathy. It's really, you know, so, you know, Armin reminds me of that in a little bit. It starts with this image. There's an old woman in a wheelie bin. My God, what's that about? And then you get the whole, not the whole, but you get little snippets of the backstory, and enough to kind of put together a picture. You know, so I guess, yeah, there was a point of reference for me.
Yes, thank you. It's really enticing for me and also reminds me of another story in the anthology. It's a novelist in the attic written by Shen Dachen and translated by Jack Hargreaves. I mean, they kind of, you know, yes. I mean, they're unrelating the sense, but, you know, from the title, you can see that there is an association to that motto, to the motive of the mad woman in the attic, you know, the cultural, transcultural reference, I guess. But, you know, welcome to read our audience to dive into this wonderful anthology. Yeah, and the last question, I think we've got just enough time before the Q&A to talk about plans. So it's also a question for you both. Like, Jan Hei, you talk about writing novels, like writing something longer, something different in subject or form in a previous interview. And I wonder, is this something that is already happening? And would you like to share more about it? Yes, please.
Yeah, in fact, I haven't get prepared and start with a new novel, but I do have such a plan to write a novel, and also nonfiction. But I think it's better to say it out after the plans come true. Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally fine. I just guess later we'll get the questions about future plans to you because, you know, people are all curious about what's coming next, but no rush about that, just a tentative question. And Chris, are there any Chinese titles that interest you recently or books that you...
Yes, I have a little too much flex.
Oh, sorry. I didn't catch.
What? Sorry.
Can you repeat that? Yeah.
It's okay. That's a question for Chris, okay.
Yeah, I just want to ask, like, both of you, in regards to your future translating or writing plans, like, Chris, are there any Chinese titles or books that you recently read and want to translate maybe in the near future?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, at the moment, I'm working on a long translation of an academic monograph for a Chinese political scientist, so that's very interesting, and that's kind of that's really got me covered for the next few months, really. You know, I'm not sure I'll be doing too much reading or translating anything else, but yeah, in terms of literature, I'd love to translate any more stories by Wang Janhei. I've read some of your other work, Janhei, and
yeah.
And I think it, you know, there's a readership in English who'd be happy to see that, so yeah.
Do you like 小花旦?
Do I like Shanghai, did you say?
Do you like 小花旦?
Oh, yes.
小花旦,
yes.
My new, sorry. Yeah.
Sorry, yes, of course. Yeah.
I want to write something longer to near an hour.
Right, yes, sorry, I didn't... Sorry, I thought you said Shanghai. Yes, Xiaohua Dan. It's very, very nice, and it's very, very it's so evocative.
Prima donna.
I suppose. Prima donna. Yeah, it's so evocative of just the feeling of life in Shanghai. You know, there's so much moving around on the streets and getting a taxi or the metro to here or there, and you really get the this kind of gritty feel of Shanghai. And when I lived there,
yeah.
I used to myself. You know, I always walked different routes to work and spent the weekend cycling and stuff because I just loved, yeah, that feeling.
Does
that
remind you of Shanghai when you lived there?
Very much so, yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to say I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you, everyone. And now I'm wondering if our audience have any questions for Janhei or Chris. You can ask now. The floor is open. Oh, go ahead. Nikki, have questions? Are you muted? Can you talk now? Can you open your microphone and... I think you're not muted, Nikki.
Nikki, we can't hear you, Nikki.
I think I unmuted you, Nikki. Maybe you can you try open your microphone? Hi, can you hear me? I think I just muted myself.
I can hear you, Dee. I'm not quite sure why we participants don't seem to have any sound. I don't know why that is.
Yeah, it shouldn't be like this. Can anyone, everyone try your microphone and see if you can properly speak?
Is Nikki speaking? No.
Or do you want to type your question in
no,
the chat?
No, now I can see a microphone sign next to Nikki, or I did for a moment. Nikki, I'm going to make you a presenter and see if that makes any difference.
And I think Rosalind also has a question. So we will talk about this question after Nikki's question. Or so maybe when Nikki is trying to solve the technical issues, would you like to answer Rosalind's question first, Jahi and Chris?
So let me go back to Jahi.
So Rosalind has a question for us. So Jahi, can you tell us that the process of engaging with Chris as a translator was like? When you are translated, does it ever make you go back to your stories and rethink or change any aspects of them? Thank you.
Oh, thank you for your question. I wrote this story at about 2014, about 5 years ago. And Chris translated about 1 year ago. So when I read the translated version, and to be frank, I'm not familiar with the story of Armin, but the story in English version make me close to Armin once again. And I really like this version, especially the rhythm of sentence, and make me think of the old days when I write this story. Yeah. The process of engaging with Chris as your translator, I'm not sure, because it's a book collection of called Books of Shanghai, and how will Chris be my translator? I'm not sure. Chris, are you here? Is Chris here?
Chris, are you
I also want to ask Chris, how did he get this book and why choose my story? I also want to know. I'm curious too.
Okay, so Jahi has a question for Chris. I think Chris may.
I think we might have lost Chris. I'm not sure where he's gone.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Just turn the mic on. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes.
Hi, Chris.
So
you can hear me. All right. Could you just repeat it? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Roshan asked, and the process of engaging you and me with the story of farming. So that is also my question. Why did you choose the story of farming from the Book of Shanghai to translate? Right. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Well, actually, it was chosen for me, if you like. I was on the Warwick Translate Summer School with Dee, and also with Nikki, who's out there somewhere, who was our instructor. And we met as part of the summer school. We met a number of publishers, and one of them was Comma Press, who kindly offered us the opportunity to translate stories for the Book of Shanghai. So we all sent in samples. We sent in samples who were interested, and you know, three of us ended up translating stories, and the one that I was given was your story. And in fact, I'd already done a sample of it. And you know, once we got the sample, I made sure to get hold of the whole story, and I loved it, and I just wanted to translate it very much. So I went the extra mile, if you like, in terms of spending as much time as I possibly could. And then on the question of engagement, of course we didn't you know each other or engage at that point. But you know, and if I had known you or been in touch, I certainly would have asked you a few of the questions about some of the little Shanghainese phrases that appear in there. And then the description of scenes like, I don't know, the scene of, I don't know, some of the landscape, you know, just I couldn't quite work out where's the bin being kept, you know, what kind of building structure is this? And I probably would have asked you a few questions like that. So, yeah, you know, maybe next time I'd be pestering you for answers. But at the time, yeah.
I think Nikki has solved the problem. Can you talk now, Nikki?
I hope so. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've got two computers on. This is not good. Hang on. there we go. I'm so sorry about messing it up before. I don't know what happened. I just wanted to say how much I enjoyed the story and the translation. And I was quite interested that Chris mentioned filial piety, because I must say that it never occurred to me to think of the story in that way. It seems to me it has a kind of universal appeal. Like most of us are going to get old, and at least half of us in the world are women. And it just so perfectly embodied the experiences of one woman. I'm so impressed that Wang Zhanhe has created such a beautiful story. When I can see you're very young, how did you manage to know? That's all. I loved it.
Thanks, Nikki.
Bee, we can't hear you. We can't hear you. Please unmute yourself if you have it.
Oh, sorry, I just muted myself. So if there's no other questions, I think we're just perfect on time. Okay, so no one has any questions. And okay, so then we will call it an end to today's event, and I hope you all enjoyed today's conversation. And thank you very much for joining us today, Zhanhe and Chris. And if you want to find out more about this brilliant anthology, it's now available on Amazon. And hope you all have a good day, and probably see you next Warwick Tuesday. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thanks so much, Dee.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you, everyone.